Episode two, we're already back on it. You guys know what it is about. Anyways, today in this second episode, first episode, if you haven't listened to it, talked about the education system. That's a particular expansion of this particular overall general point that I'm going to be getting across here. I've probably made like five episodes on this, but I'm talking about why communism sucks. I'm mainly talking about actually why free markets are good. Some people like to use the term capitalist, some people don't. And it is what it is. I like the word capitalism because it emphasizes the expansion of innovation based off of profit. Capitalism. Take capital and you use that to expand and innovate. It's a beautiful thing, but I'm going to be talking about one of the most fatal flaws of socialism slash communism. What is socialism slash communism? What do they mean? What are the difference between the two? Aren't they the same thing? Aren't they different? Well, this is something I have gone a little bit further out of my way to educate myself on a little bit more. And I've begun reading the Communist Manifesto, trying to dig into it and understand it, not because I'm one of them, but because if you don't seriously challenge your beliefs, and if you do not understand the approach of the other side, then how can you ever honestly really believe that you're right? And of course, I wholeheartedly believe that I am right. And I'm going to be explaining to you why I am right in this capitalism versus communism slash socialism episode. Here I am once more talking about communism slash socialism versus capitalism. Now, let's open this right out of the gate. Let me demonstrate my understanding of the opposing philosophy. Tyson! Tyson! What's the difference between communism and socialism?
Well, I reckon they're both the same.
They're not both the same. Democratic socialism is completely different than communism.
We are a democratic socialist.
That was my Bernie Sanders interpretation. What is it? What's the difference between communism and socialism? Now, if you look at the history of communism, you recognize communist countries as the USSR, Russia, right? North Korea, China, Vietnam, and Cuba. Those are some popular ones, just to throw them out there. Right? You have other ones that split up, Romania, whatever, parts that were a part of the USSR. Right? So when you look at communism, right, and the original anti-communist position, most capitalists will explain, is not real communism, right? Where Stalin killed 20 million people and Pol Pot killed eight or whatever. So you've got all these different examples of where communism has, quote, been attempted and has just failed miserably. And it's been practical genocide for the country attempting to embody communism, right? So communism is the idea. So it would. The way that it works is almost as if like libertarian ideas were bad, right? It would be like, I'm a libertarian, right? And I feel like the only way to be a real libertarian is to be pragmatic where you have to be, but to ideally be anarcho-capitalist. Be an anarcho-capitalist in principle and to advocate, no matter how small, for the minor abolitions of government responsibilities over things. And communism, the difference between communism and socialism in that way is similar to the contrast between libertarianism and anarcho-capitalism, right? And not all libertarians are anarcho-capitalists, and not all socialists are communists, right? But all communists are socialists, and I would argue that all anarcho-capitalists are libertarian. They are libertarian ideas. So, communism is the goal. Communism is the ideal, right? Now, if you're ever debating a communist, one of the very most typical questions that they will ask you in order to disproves capitalism, but they say, well, define it. Define communism then. And so, you know, many people would define communism in different ways. Now, typically, the most unapologetic definition of communism by a non-communist would go something like, the government controls the money and will then control every part of your life. Or complete government control, right? But to take the communist philosophy in its rawest form, right, we must understand, because this philosophy came from their rules and definitions, right? So in order to understand it and to properly combat it intellectually, we must face the reality of what communism is. And frankly, the only real way to do that is to pluck the definition of communism straight from those who preach it. The best definition of communism that I have been aware of, and frankly, if you brought this definition to any communist, they would not disagree with this being a definition of communism. They would agree with this definition. Perhaps they're nuanced, highly educated in the philosophy, and ideal society might tweak a few words here and there, or add something, right? But the most, by this ideology, I would say the most universally accepted definition of communism would be the workers' seizure and control of the means of production. Now let's break this down, right? The workers, right? This is what the communists call the proletariat. Okay, there's two classes in the communist ideology. You have the bourgeoisie, which is the rich class, the capitalist class, they call them, right? And then you have the proletariat, which would be the working class. It'd be everyday people. I would be a proletariat, right? And if you're listening to this, you likely would be a proletariat. The 99% is the proletariat. The 1% is the bourgeoisie. Say that. I know you guys are listening. You're not necessarily interacting. Just say bourgeoisie. I feel very cultured. Anyways, you have these two classes, right? So the workers seizing and controlling the means of production. The proletariat, right? And if you understand, this is going to help you understand the philosophy of communism a little bit better. The proletariat seizing, and this most certainly, and this was actually emphasized by Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto, the proletariat violently taking the means of production, which is the ability to produce goods or services in some cases. It was more so, we didn't really have such a service-based economy as we do today, right? In the case of communism in the 1920s, or 1820s, or whenever it really first started. I know Marx was very big in the 1800s. His ideas really came to pass in the 1918 it must have been, 1917, when Russia pulled out of the First World War because of the Bolshevik Revolution, right? The proletariats. But anyways, even up to that point, right, we were never really a service-based society until about, I mean, at least the end of World War II, at the bare minimum. But you can see that we really start to make that shift in the 50s and 60s. And then the service-based society has just exponentially grown since then. And then the amount of consumer products for consumers that are services, and the amount of service that goes into those consumer-based products is just beyond what we have ever witnessed before. But anyways, my point in saying that is that more so the means of production was not necessarily a service-based thing. It was more of a product-based thing, right? Which I find very interesting because this leads into basically the most fatal flaw of communism. And I kind of wanted to save this for later, but this is such an important point for us to emphasize, right? Without, if so, let's say that Marx and Lenin had their intuitions and predictions come to pass, right? Let's say that the proletariat worldwide overthrows the bourgeoisie and controls the means of production. If that were to happen, we simply could not have this service-based consumer market that we do today. It wouldn't be the same. In fact, this is why it completely embodies the idea that communism stifles. I need to not do this right now. We need to backtrack here a little bit. The difference between communism and socialism. That's the definition of communism, right? And so I don't want to come straight out of the gate and attack communism because I want to lead into this, right? Because those with the communist philosophy would argue that you can't really, that the flaw doesn't lie with communism, right? You see these catastrophes, you see these examples of horrific things happening. You see these failed communist or socialist states, right? And that is the common ammunition against communism. And so a communist would say, well, that wasn't real communism, right? Here's what socialism is, right? So if you're going from left to right, you've got three phases here, right? On the left-hand side, you have capitalism. In the middle, you have capitalism, which goes to socialism. And then you have socialism to communism, right? So what is socialism? In order for the workers, now this is where the flaw will generally come in. This is what you call a slippery slope. This is possibly the big fault, right? But ultimately, what this is the pragmatic explanation, the pragmatic, it's the pragmatic middle of the road appeal to general society on how to guide us to communism, right? So if you like any ideology, you're not going to get very many people to agree with you if I come out and say, you know what we need to do? We need to just violently overthrow the government and then never establish one again. That's right, because that's what, if you're to immediately achieve anarcho-capitalism, that's what it would be, right? And this is the thing about a state in general, right? The inherent characteristics that it will always have is as soon as you, like, really, if you have an ideal and then you have a state, like, that ideal is bound to be switched unless your ideal is complete totalitarianism. And in the case of communism, there's no real set in stone. Like, and this is why you get so many branches of varying communism and why you see so many different strands of it. But there's no set in stone cultural agenda or cultural guidelines for, like, what the ideology of communism is culturally. Right, which is why you see such a broad expansion of it. Right, you see, anarcho-communism, and in anarcho-communism, you know, the idea would be the proletariat or the working class would violently overthrow the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, the employers. Right, I find this analogy between, like, the working class and the capitalist class, or the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, I find it most accurately and sensibly put in the terms of the employers and the employees, because that is what it is, really, right? Now the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, I'm not necessarily sure, like, the historical and time relative notions that were associated with those words, right? But, you know, the working class and capitalist class just kind of, like, leads the presumption that the capitalist class doesn't work. And this is kind of where, and it's kind of the idea in some ways, but this is where it gets interesting, right? So socialism is like it's like the path to communism, right? So communism is where the workers immediately seize and control the means of production. And socialism basically says it uses the state, right? Because that's how you're going to appeal to people. You have to make it sensible, right? If you're advocating for the violent overthrow of your Starbucks, then not many people are going to really think that's a very appealing idea. Right? Not many people are going to be like, oh, yeah, you know what? Screw Walmart. You know, let's let all the Walmart workers go and kill the CEO of Walmart. Or even some people won't say that. Just never let the managers back into the store or whatever the construct might be, right? But not I'm not making the implication that the managers don't work, but, you know, the managers just decide, well, we're not going to work with corporate anymore. We're going to take this building. We're going to take the products. We're going to take, you know, the money. We're just going to not associate with Walmart anymore. We're just going to take this and not be Walmart. So socialism, basically, like, okay, so rather than the workers literally controlling the means of production, right, the ability, like the factory, for example, right, the machinery and the building, right, controlled, owned, guarded by the workers, it is instead done by a democratic government. Because the workers would indirectly be controlling the means of production through that democratic government's seizure of the means of production, right? So we're going to go two different routes here, right? I'm going to attack communism from two different fronts. We're going to fight. Here's the capitalist front right here. Two different battles right here against communism. Both of these ideas on how it should work, right? And here's why anarcho-capitalism itself, let alone even libertarianism in a pragmatic way, but anarcho-capitalism itself would disprove the foundational ideas for how these things would work. Now, some people, you know, who are socialists, as I said, all communists are socialists, but not all socialists are communists, right? And you have, like, orthodox communists, like orthodox Marxists in there, or anarcho-communists or something like that. I'm gonna attack three different fronts here. Here's what I'm gonna do. I'm attacking the socialist front, right? The stagnation at socialism, right? The democratic socialism, the people that don't, like, the libertarians that aren't anarcho-capitalists, like the people that don't think that we need communism, but they're socialists, right? The people that use socialism as a means to achieve communism. And then the anarcho-communists, which just advocate for the violent abolition of the capitalist class. Right. So first of all, how can I make this the most simple? Let's go ahead. This is the easiest one. So I'm going to do this, right? Using socialism as a mean to achieve communism. Right. Essentially, right, if you're to boil communism down in sense of, like, making it as simple in layman government terms, you know, it's democracy at its fullest extent, right? Applied to basically everything. Every aspect of life is done through democracy, right? It's a classless and moneyless society. That's what it is, and communists will agree with this. It's a classless, moneyless society, right? So what you do in socialism is, you know, you have the government control and seize the means of production, right? So now you have this, let's even leave it as a democratic body, right? I'm gonna make the assumption that, you know, This is what I'm going to attack at the staying socialist stage. So if you are going to attempt, and this is, I mean, if you look at like really what China's trying to do, is they're in the socialist phase of trying to become communist. So people, well, they're communists. It's the Communist Party, right? The communists in China, they call themselves socialists, and they say that they have not yet achieved communism, right? But they are working to achieve communism. Okay, so we're going to take that at face value because we're going to play by the rules here, right? Not that I don't think that it's bullcrap anyways, because it involves the state and the implications and inevitable things that come with that. But that's the idea, right? So the reason why this is so faulty is practically, it's because you're giving the state this ability, right? I have never once in all of my history learnings and I've never once witnessed, heard of, learned of the establishment of a state which minimized itself. It just doesn't do that. Because frankly, the state has the authority, power, right? And this comes, right? This is the interesting aspect of a state, which makes it inherently bad, which inevitably will always lead to these same conclusions, is the fact that the state is the overarching authority in a region. So because of that, the state has the authority to maintain a monopoly on violence. Right, if you don't like what the government's doing, well, good luck stopping them. Right, and now there's democratic ways that you can slow it down. Right, ultimately, it's going to end up in some sort of a compromise, which is still the withering away of the rights of the people. You know, you can slow it down, but ultimately, the states don't relinquish their power. They never have. They don't. It's just not in the characteristics of a state. It cannot manifest itself. It cannot come to pass. It just can't happen, right? It won't happen. It has never happened. So, you know, to have the idea that, you know, you, and realistically, that, why is it more pragmatic to assume that people should be okay with violence if it's done on behalf of a democratic government rather than just the workers violently seizing it? Because, you know, if those businesses don't want to comply with this democratic government seizing the means of production, well, that's bad news, because you already know what that monopoly on violence has the authority to do in the region. Right? You don't want to, I mean, that's just, you're just asking for trouble if you're the company at that point, right? So I find it, this is what I find, like, ironic about it, is, you know, you do that in order to appeal it to regular people, right, under the presumption, which is somehow breaks my heart, but it's somehow correct, that violence at the government, violence by government is acceptable. And this is, frankly, what the whole idea of capitalism is built on. It's built off of cooperation and nonviolence, mutual agreement to benefit both parties. But the entire process of communism is directly face to face confronted with this problem, that the only way that it could possibly be achieved is through violence. Whether that's done by the government or whether it's done by the proletariat, right? The working class. But regardless, either way, it's done by violence. It has to be. Right? Because you're not coming in here and taking my laptop or everything that I've worked for, you know? So, you know, people are reluctant to give up their accomplishments, and I don't blame them. I am too. You work for that stuff, right? But regardless, right, that's the idea, is that socialism is used to achieve communism. Now, what about social democracy or even democratic socialism, right? Democratic socialism is more so the proper it's the more specific proper transitional term for socialism, if you're going to use that, Right. Other than a social democracy, which are two different things. Like, you look at Sweden and Denmark, like, most of these countries that are used for good examples of socialism are small countries, very ethnically similar, that have a social democracy. And a social democracy is not quite the same as owning, as the government seizing and owning the means of production. Rather so, it's the government that is manifested through companies that participate in the market, right? And the communists will call it free market, but it's not a free market when there's regulations imposed that what's the word I'm looking for? That profit, that favor, right? When there's regulations that favor the government's owned companies, that obviously can't be a free market because there's nothing free about the use of violence in the economy, right? There's nothing free about that. But regardless, right, that's a social democracy, right? It's very like there's capitalist aspects, there's socialist aspects, and some people will even be make the case, this is the second front that I'm going to be attacking this philosophy on, that we're fine to remain a social democracy or a democratic socialism with the government either partially owning or majorly regulating the means of production, or the government completely owning the means of production, right? And for that, I will say this is where we see these travesties happen, right? Because frankly, if you really think about it, right, it's not quite the same as like the idea of communism is to rip out from under of the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, right? Is to immediately free the working class, which is in chains. That's so as the philosophy goes, of course. Right? Of course, I do not think the proletariat is in chains in any regard. But that is the idea. So what good does it do to just stick a state into the process and really in the way that it plays out, and expect this newly installed bourgeoisie class to do what's in the best interest of the democracy, when you have more say over it in the market than you do in a democracy? What's interesting about this is in a democracy, if I'm in a democracy of 300 million people, my vote is 1/300 millionth of the say. In a market, I buy what I want to buy and I don't buy what I don't want to buy. It's very simple. It's fantastic, actually. It's absolutely beautiful. So, anyways, you add a state into this, which you are playing with fire, right? I would say that you're playing with nuclear fusion without the proper equipment to maintain it, because there's no possible way. It's like you've got dark matter in your bedroom. Right, and if you don't know what that means, just basically think of it this way: it's uncontainable and it's bound to be a catastrophe. That's basically how I would state it. I'm not some crazy astrophysicist. This is just my basic understanding of that. Right, obviously that's not my area of expertise, but you get what I'm saying. So it's like an open flame by gasoline, whatever. Not even that. It's way more catastrophic and way less controllable. So you're playing. To make it simple, you're playing with fire here, right? You're gonna get hurt. Someone's gonna get hurt. I'm the dad. Quit roughhousing, right? Someone's gonna get hurt. This is a bad idea. And what has happened every time, right? People are obviously getting hurt. That's an understatement, of course. Like, over 100 million people have died because of communism. People are getting hurt. Let's just recognize it, right? People are getting hurt. They've been getting hurt. Which is why, orthodox Marxists or communists will never accept these attempts at it, because people have gotten hurt and that can't be their fault. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't want it to be my fault either. I'm not the one that has the philosophy built around violence, though. But someone's getting hurt. So, I mean, you're playing with fire. I mean, you're sticking this state into the system, and it just doesn't it doesn't make it better. In fact, it arguably makes it worse, right? But let's just ignore this thing, right? We're going to fight this on his third front. Okay? So, what happens if the proletariat just violently overthrows the bourgeoisie, right? The workers overthrow the capitalists, the employees overthrow the employers. Right now, all the employees are just, oh, yeah, it's our company now. We're like Winko. Right? So, at this point, basically, you know, you've got this society now, which is classless and moneyless, right? And there's no artificially created, just bull crap concept of doing any progress by shifting the bourgeoisie to an institution or organization that has a monopoly on violence, right? That's completely counterproductive. It's like a step in the opposite direction, right? So, you know, rather than like being like, okay, you know, we have this problem here, you know, of, you know, and this is just an allegory, right? But we have this problem here of, you know, a snake biting on me, right? So what we're going to do is we're just going to make it a bigger snake. Or put another snake on me. It doesn't help the situation. It doesn't actually really make sense. Right? Because honestly, this is with the understanding that government is inherently evil. So we skip the government thing anyways, right? I just don't understand that part. Right? Like, socially, sociologically, behaviorally, when it comes to power struggle, and when it comes to the ultimate goal, it makes no sense. It has no real basis, right? It's bound to fail. It's completely counteractive to the goal. It just doesn't make sense. So, okay, so the proletariat violently overthrows the employers, the bourgeoisie, right? Now the workers own the means of production directly. Okay, then what happens? Well, you have a classless and moneyless society. And, you know, this is perhaps this is a great flaw of communism to capitalize, right? But it's something called the economic calculation problem. It was Mises or Hayek, I'm pretty sure, that came up with it. But basically, right, if you have a moneyless society, and this is the example you use with me, and I've said this before on the show, but if you have a moneyless society, in which all communists would agree that communist society would be a moneyless society, and you are building a train track, assuming that the innovation and the idea and the need for expansion could even be comprehended or organized somehow, right? But somehow people determine that it's worth it by whatever means they do to build a railroad track. In a moneyless society, right, you're building the railroad track and you come across a mountain without being able to calculate the cost to either blow through the mountain or to build around the mountain, there is no mean to determine which mode of production or approach to production / expansion is more efficient. Without money, there is no way to determine, there is no general universal objective way to determine which ideas, systems, and such are more efficient than others. Now, some people will say that communism disincentivizes people to work. I would frankly agree. You know, and a communist wouldn't, because they would say that ideally as a society, everyone is not working towards gathering capital or money. They are working towards advancing society in general. And you're assuming everyone is on the same page as that. You're assuming that that's not going to get taken advantage of by the selfish people. Not to mention that regardless, the philosophy of communism is built around selfishness. And even furthermore, the concept of anarcho-communism is additionally built on even more selfishness, because without a state to enforce anything, the philosophy of anarcho-communism must assume that human nature is selfish in order for their ideology to make sense or for it to play out. Right? In an anarcho-communist mind, A society, right, a democratically led society, would violently overthrow and maintain control of the means of production. That is with the assumption, that must come with the assumption, This society is selfish. It is going to take what has been given to them. Right? So why? How is that logic consistent? So the assumption that this general motive is going to remain among all people. Right? That is a nonsense idea. Right? The ideas of communism exploit surplus value. In fact, they eradicate surplus value, right? By distributing it to people. Well, what happens with that, right? What is the point of capitalism? Capitalism is you take your capital, right, your profit, and rather than exploiting that surplus value that you gather from creating an efficient product that brings you in more money, you grow it and make the product better. You expand the market. You expand your consumer base. You offer a variation. You offer a more efficient system. Right? So, you are eradicating, right? When you exploit surplus value like that by immediately redistributing it to the workers, you are eradicating the ability to expand, grow, and innovate. By exploiting surplus value, you are eradicating the ability to grow and innovate. And that is simply factual. Right? Without surplus value, there is no investment. Right? And an investment is very arbitrary. I'm going to college, I'm investing. Right? I'm investing my time and money into my education. Right? You are listening to this. You are investing time into this. Right? I am making this. I am investing time into producing these ideas. An investment is very arbitrary. It can be applied to a lot of different things. And, you know, when it comes to getting anything done in this world, right, you seemingly need money. Really. Because if you can't pay the bills, you can't save the world. Right? I mean, that's the bottom of the line. So, when it comes to the more practical things, like what really makes society better, such as innovation, with no investment into new innovation, you have a state of permanent stagnation. Now, let's think about it this way. Maybe a communist would say something like, okay, what the employers do, is they bar out the employees. They exclude the employees, right? The employers are making more money while the wages of the employees are not increasing. Now, this is simply not true, as the most impoverished people of today are living a higher standard of living than the most, you know, the least impoverished people of, you know, centuries ago, right? The quality of life for every living being on this planet, whether it's more in first world countries and less in third world countries, the quality of life for every living being on this planet, except for like people on the North Sentinel Islands, has been increased because of capitalism. Because of the innovation and the increase of the quality of life. Now, communism advocates for an abolition of innovation. Without surplus value, there is no investment. There's no new ideas. There's no reallocation of excess resources. So you are eradicating the ability to improve the quality of life. And instead you're saying, okay, here's the average quality of life now versus the richest and the poorest. And what we're going to do is we're all going to mesh in the middle and stay here forever. What an absurd concept. And frankly, I don't want to do that. If you look at like graphs, right, a line graph, what it is with capitalism, you're going to have your ups and downs. I mean, you are. There's going to be times where the market maybe isn't doing as good. Now, frankly, I will say that many issues in the market are because of government intervention. I'll say this, 90% of problems in the market would be solved by eradicating the government, and the other 10% will just always be there regardless of what system you support. I mean, they're just going to be there. I mean, there will always be conflict in society. That is unavoidable. That is inevitable. right? But the majority of these problems, if you look at recessions and depressions, are caused by government intervention. But regardless, you know, you'll have a lot of ups and you'll have some downs. But overall, right, and just like you see with the quality of life and the poverty rates, there's a trend and it's continuously going in the same direction, and that is the overall increase in the quality of life of people. And with communism, you cannot have that. Immediately, you level out between the ups and the downs and you stagnate permanently. You permanently stagnate. Which is, it's a bewildering concept, but there's no possible way to reinvest when you're exploiting surplus value. And this leads to the other flaw of communism. Frankly, communism must be a bogus philosophy. This, if there's one fault in communism, it is likely this. This is, well, it ties into that, exactly, but communism, in order to work, because of that stagnation, must take what capitalism has already achieved. Communism cannot reproduct itself. It cannot remain sustainable. When there is an exploitation of surplus value in your factory, and every worker is receiving every bit of the profit equally portioned out, what happens when a machine breaks? Who will allocate their capital slash resources slash profits, in order to invest into fixing that machine, or to buy a new machine? With no measurement of incentives, with no ability to act upon values, there is no ability to measure the values and the desires of the society, of consumers. You are forever stagnating. If you have the same ingredients, right, and which I find even more funny, because the allocation of the value, the surplus value, would essentially make it so that you would only have the supplies that you have with communism, and then you would run out. Right? When it comes to the action of it in place, right, it's a very narrow-minded philosophy, because it's a utopia. Right, and there's no answers for the economic calculation problem, right, in the moneyless society building the railroad track, right? There's no real solution to that. I've never heard one, and I've gone searching for it. There's no real solution to that. Right? And just like this, who if the workers are owning it, right, and maybe you just have a board or whatever, right? But the allocation of surplus profits there must be surplus profits in order to reinvest into, say you have a bakery, into more flour, because you're going to run out of flour. Right. And then that brings on a whole other interesting construct to see, you know, if a board of 10 executives is really just communism, right. Which is interesting. And you know, it's just this whole jimble jamble of bullcrap philosophy talking points that ultimately got stumped a long time ago, right? And there's so many different faults along the path of communism here, right? But ultimately, right, the ability to reallocate resources would be to the maximum made inefficient, right? Not to mention that even though communism is a moral philosophy forever divorced with its practice, capitalism is, and here's the flaw with communism. Communism can never make a great case for itself independently. What must communists do in order to make the case for communism? They must acknowledge capitalism. Right? And I will not do that from the capitalist perspective in this video. I do not need to acknowledge communism in order to make the case for capitalism. That is the flaw with communism. Right? To make the case for capitalism, it is very simple. I provide and create a product that people find useful. right? Sometimes they don't. I don't make money. It was a waste of an investment. I learned from it. That's entrepreneurship, right? There's ups and downs, okay? But let's say I make a new shoe, right? And with this new shoe, I make money. And let's say I make $5 million from selling the shoe. What do? I built two new factories, right? Just in case the company starts failing, I've got $2.5 million stashed away, right? So I can maybe change what I'm doing, hang on for a little bit longer, right? It's an investment, right? Or I can cash out regardless, right? Take $2.5 million, reinvest it. And frankly, that is a very conservative model. Companies are investing much more of their profits into expanding their company than half. I mean, they are. That's just the way that the numbers work. I mean, it's because a company that's dealing with those kind of numbers, I mean, when you see that kind of growth, it's like buying stocks, you want more. And it makes sense. And there's nothing wrong with that, because if you're making more money, obviously you're being beneficial to the consumers. Because if you weren't, they wouldn't want to buy your product. So here's the case for capitalism. Capitalism is inherently the correct moral philosophy because it incentivizes individuals to capitalize on their strengths based off of their personal values. It is built around free choice, cooperation, camaraderie, right? It is all based off of free choice. You want your cooperation. You want the success of people to come mutually. You and everyone to get along, that's phenomenal. But you know what's even better than everyone just getting along? It happening from the shake of a hand, right? Not the state putting its boot on your neck, right? But it's happening through cooperation. Why? Why does that happen through cooperation? How, when the profits of the capitalist class are so massively, exponentially larger than the paychecks of the proletariat or the working class, how are they not in chains? Well, it is simple. You do not have to work for that person, right? My boss makes more money than I do. That is practical. My boss was the one that put the investment to make those machines there. He took on all of the financial risk. I just worked for him. I took on zero financial risk. Rather, I worked for an agreed upon wage. This is how it is entirely built off of selfishness. What is good for the consumer is good for the business owner. That is what incentivizes reinvestment. And what incentivizes me stealing my boss's investment and the financial risk that was taken, That embodies selfishness. It's not practical. It doesn't make any sense, right? I had no financial risk in doing that. Zero. I haven't invested any money into it. In fact, I've only received money from it. If anything, I'm benefiting more from these circumstances, because if that business fails at any time, who's the one losing the major portion of money? Who's losing their assets? I lose a job, but there are plenty of other businesses out there I could go get a job at. Meanwhile, my boss loses basically everything. So how are the proletariat possibly the victims in this circumstance? Communism seeks to eradicate the foundation the proletariat class is able to have a sustainable quality of life on. It's such an obscene philosophy, right? But capitalism essentially, right, and I've talked about this on the episode before, capitalism must be the natural selection for humans. And why is that, right? We have a government because we are a sophisticated species, right? And I don't think that we need a government in order to be compassionate, right? But communists will say everyone has a right to food. Everyone has a right to water. You don't have a right to someone else's labor. That's involuntary servitude. That is slavery. And communism is the advocation for the majority being enslavement to the majority. I will be enslaved to nobody. But That being said, right, capitalism, regardless, has to be the correct philosophy for not only these monetarily sound but morally correct positions of investments and risk and profit and reinvestment and appealing to the consumers and so forth. But it must be our natural selection because we are complex creatures, right? And the society that we live in is one that is very different from the animal kingdom, right? It is something that is, we are not a society built on violence as communism advocates for, but regardless, we are not a society that is built on violence. We are not a society that is built on war, right? We are a society that is built on knowledge and growth, right? The quality of life has grown exponentially because we understand this. We understand that we are growing. And when we grow and when innovation happens, everyone is better off. So when you have someone that observes the human community, right, the market, right, and I look over here into Nebraska, and I say, dang, they ain't got no fish. I feel like they could use some fish. So I buy a refrigerated truck, and I drive to Seattle, and I go fishing, or I buy fish in Seattle where it's cheaper. And then I bring these fish to a place that is lacking it in the market, right? And this is hypothetical, of course, this is an allegory, right? But I bring these fish, this product, to a place that I see that product might fit into the market, to where it might benefit the consumers, to where the consumers would be willing to place it higher on their value scale than $5 a pound. I think that the fish, a pound of fish, is more important to me than $5. So I will trade my $5 for a pound of fish. That is human action. That is what society is built off of. That is what behavior is built off of. That is what capitalism is built off of. It's a fantastic theory. It was put forth by Ludwig von Mises majorly, and Murray Rothbard wrote Mad Economy and State on it, and in a more, it's a scholarly edition of Human Action. Human Action is a very hard book. Even Mad Economy and State is a very hard book. And I have a really hard time with it sometimes because it is just these incredibly complex structures just broken down into these details. And everything is consistent with it. It's all sound, right? But that is how it works, right? And so when I am sitting here, right, and I own my shoemaking factory, and I've got 10 machines in this one factory, and I've got $5 million profit, and oh no, one of my machines broke down, that's going to cost me $100,000. Okay, let's say I made $5 million profit a year, right? We'll just divide it right down, right? Say I made $500,000 of profit on each shoe thing, on each shoe machine, right? Because we got 10 machines and $5 million profit. And so I made $500,000 profit on each shoe machine. Then it cost me $100,000 to fix that shoe machine. Obviously, it's in my best interest if I fix that shoe machine, a shoemaking machine, right? This is the system. The system of decisions is capitalism, right? Or at least a free market, right? Some people may say capitalism is exploitative. How could it possibly be exploitative with a shake of a hand and an agreed upon wage? Right? And this is what I like to tell communists. Even if the wages are too low, right? Or even if you feel like you deserve to be paid more, what is stopping you from becoming an investor and creating your own wage, right? If your labor is so valuable, then why don't you go turn that labor independently into value? Capitalism allows you to do that. Capitalism allows you to manifest your destiny. Communism allows nobody to manifest their destiny. I could go on, you know, the little nitpicky examples here, but I think I got the point through pretty good. Feedback, give it to me, give it to me, give it to me. This is another episode of Utah Liberty Talk, another episode of why capitalism must inherently be correct, but more so This episode is about debunking communism, right? That last little section there was just so I could prove that I could kind of make a capitalist case based off of human behavior without having to use communism as a reason against it, right? I'm not going to say we need capitalism because communism is so bad. Communism can only make its case with capitalism, right? Communism needs to manipulate something in order to make itself look good. Capitalism, well, it's just good and works on its own. Thanks for listening, ladies and gentlemen. You guys have a good day. Take care. Thanks for the support. And we'll see you on the next episode of Utah Liberty Talk.